You probably shouldn't listen to much that I say.
Amen!
Thanks, thanks. Appreciate that. I'm sure that some of it is inaccurate. And I'm pretty sure that some of it is unorthodox. And I'm certain that a percentage of it is completely and utterly heretical. And yet, week after week, you come and you sit and you listen, or at least you do a really good job of pretending to listen to me, because I stand up here, because I have gone to seminary and studied stuff, or because I have gifts and graces for pastoral ministry, and you recognize that, or because I speak as one who has authority, and so you listen to at least some of what I say. But I submit to you that you probably shouldn't do that, or at the very least, you should question what you hear, even though it comes out of my mouth, perhaps especially because it comes out of my mouth. So you should question what I have to say, even this, in the moment of preaching, and perhaps especially this. Because what I have to say is this. I hate this story. I absolutely hate it. And if I could take a black magic marker and scribble it out in every Bible everywhere, I would do it. What an awful story. Now, I could submit to you, I could present to you a reading of this story where we take it purely as a metaphor. And we say it's kind of a tall tale, it's kind of a fable, and it exists to show us how great Abraham's faith is, and that those who are very faithful do not hesitate to give up even that which they love most for God. Kind of like when Jesus says in the New Testament, those who love their life will lose it. Those who are willing to lose their lives for my sake will gain it. But I still think that this is a really bad story to make that point. And something about this story resonates in me as being at least partially factual. Something in this story is like, it's just weird enough that it might have happened. And it speaks to me in a way. I mean, when you read a Bible passage and then it haunts you all week, you kind of know that that's the one you should preach on, you know? And this story haunts me all week. Every week it comes up, so it's probably the one I should preach on. And I'm not going to give the sermon about those who love their lives will lose it. Not this week. So let's look at this story, right? We remember from a couple weeks ago that Abraham and Sarah, who were nearing 100 years old, had not been able to have a child together, and that this had been a source of great sorrow for them. For we figure 80 years, you know, this is a big deal. And they prayed to God, and they did everything they could think of to try to figure out what was wrong and have a child together. And it just wasn't working out until one day these sort of strangers show up and say, by this time next year, you'll have a son. And Sarah laughs at that. But sure enough, lo and behold, they have a son in their old age, a son who is their legacy. Now, Abraham had another legacy. We talked about that last week. But the son who is Sarah's only son, who is their legacy. They've waited so long for this. And here's their son. And then God says, hey, Abraham, here's what I want you to do. I want you to kill your son. And that'll prove, what? That you love me, that you fear me. And Abraham, if he struggles with that command, it doesn't make the story. All we're told is Abraham gathers up the wood and the knife and his son and loads up a donkey and he goes off into the wilderness to climb a mountain and sacrifice his son. And you kind of have to wonder how Isaac felt about all of this. Gee, thanks, Dad. That's great. How Sarah felt about all this. You did what? Your father did what? You kind of have to wonder how Abraham felt about all this, because we don't really get that. It seems like he's just sort of dispassionately going through what he's been told to do. But we don't get any of that. So we're just left to wonder what's happening. An angel of the Lord intervenes at the last possible moment and stops Abraham from killing his son. But I would suggest that the damage has been done. Abraham cuts his son off from the altar, lifts him, I would presume, into his arms, carries him home, but we're never told again of Abraham and Isaac having a single conversation with one another. We are actually never told again of Abraham and God having a single conversation together. It is the angel who stops Abraham, and it is the angel who, at the end of the chapter, tells Abraham that he will be rewarded for his faithfulness. But Abraham, who used to bicker with God, who used to talk to God like they were just two folks standing right next to each other, never speaks to God again. I have several problems with this story. The first is the child sacrifice. Let's start there, okay? I love God. I've committed my life to serving, in some way or other, God. Going where I'm sent. Speaking words that I think God has given me to speak. You know, living in such a way that hopefully it invites other people to live in relationship with God and with each other in covenant and sacred community. And I tell you this right now. The day that God tells me, hey, Becca, take your daughter out back and kill her, and that'll prove you love me, is the day I walk away from ministry, and I walk away from the church, and I walk away from any relationship with the holy, I bet, and I go check myself into a mental institution. There are people. See? The call of a child is a sacred and a beautiful thing. And we do not ignore that. There are people who do this. There are people who believe God has told them to do harm to their children, even kill them. And they do that. And you know what we do? We don't even put them in jail because we recognize that they're too sick to be there. They are crazy. They are insane, and everybody knows that. We don't even have to have a law to tell us that. We don't have to have it written down somewhere to tell us, don't kill your kids. We know that's wrong. We know when we read this story that that's wrong. And in fact, that's because of where we live and when we live. Because in Abraham's time and place, that wasn't necessarily wrong, or it wasn't considered wrong the way we consider it wrong today. In fact, lots of cultures and lots of people were engaging in child sacrifice. And this story sets the Israelites apart as the people who don't practice child sacrifice, because God says, stop. It's not the last time we have a story like this, though. So obviously, it happens. It continues to happen. But it is from a different cultural time and place. But I have to imagine that, I don't imagine this often because I'd get a big head and then my hats wouldn't fit, but I have to imagine that if I were the God of the universe, for example, and I wanted to communicate to people throughout time that I'm a different God than you think God is or than you've heard of before. I don't like child sacrifice. I think it's wrong. If I wanted to communicate that, I could, I suppose, put that on a tablet somewhere. Or I could tell people a story. A story that's so powerful and gut-wrenching and painful that when you read it or hear it, you have to say, oh, wow, yeah, that is wrong. Our God doesn't do that. Our God doesn't ask us of that. Not anymore, anyway. I might tell a story to people throughout time so that they could get the message that I wanted them to get. So maybe I can deal with the child sacrifice piece if what this is a change, and it's telling us something new. Now, the second problem I have is with Abraham. I have a problem with his obedience. Let's not forget that just a couple of chapters ago, Abraham and God got into a full-on debate about what God intended to do to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, which had essentially violated hospitality codes and done violence upon God's messengers. And God is going to literally firebomb these cities, wipe them off the map of the Middle East forever. And Abraham, knowing one person who lives in these cities, argues with God and says, no, wait, there could be good people living there, innocent children. You can't just wholesale destroy them. And God says, oh, I'm going to do that. And Abraham says, wait, what if you find 100 people who are good? What if you find 50? What if you find 10? What if you find 5? What if you find 1? Would you save the city for that? And Abraham and God heckle about this. Abraham has a relationship with God that allows him to ask a question, to question God's justice, to question God's actions, and to say, this is wrong. I get that you're God and everything, but something about this doesn't fit with what I believe you to be, God of life, God of love. Flash forward a few years, and he will not question God for the life of his own son? His young son, his son that he waited and prayed for years, for decades, he will not so much as hesitate and say, what did Isaac do? How does killing him prove anything? He won't hesitate there, and I wonder sometimes if Abraham hasn't become blinded by the blessing he's received. Having received a blessing from God, has he suddenly become so overpowered by that blessing that he has lost the ability to question? Does he suddenly become so overwhelmed with, wow, if God can do that, then I can't be in a relationship with God. I just have to be God's puppet. I have to be God's completely obedient servant and not even ask a question about that because God is powerful enough to make a 100-year-old barren woman pregnant, so I'm not going to mess with that. God is powerful enough to give me what I want. So even when God is saying to take it away, I'm not gonna question. And I wonder if we don't sometimes do that, if we don't sometimes look on the blessings we've received and say, wow, we've been so blessed, who are we to question if God wants those people over there to suffer, or even for us to suffer sometime? We've been so blessed, it's not ours to question. We owe God not to question. But ultimately, that's not my biggest problem with this story. You see, Leonard Sweet, in his book, Out of the Question into the Mystery, proposes that Abraham is tested in several ways. He's tested in his obedience. He gets an A. Good job. He's tested in his faith. He gets a C-. He's forgotten that faith includes that dialogue with God, that relationship with God. What do we call it when we talk to God, when we dialogue with God, when we have a conversation with God? We call that prayer, right? We call that the life of prayer. He's forgotten that part with God. And then Abraham is tested in terms of his relationship, not only with God, but with his son, with his wife, with his family and friends and community. And as one of my friends put it, if this is what it looks like to pass that test, may I always fail. And then Sweet asks another question. He asks, can God, does God ever ask something of us that is immoral? If a word comes to us that tells us to do something immoral and wrong and evil, can it really be the word of God? And that's my problem. My problem is that Abraham is praised for his action. He's praised later by the angel who says he will be rewarded. He's praised throughout history. He's praised as sort of the father of the faith. He's praised by the tradition that this was the right thing to do. To be willing to kill his son, at the very least, was the right thing to do. And that's my problem. The text suggests that God endorses this, that God praises this. Maybe not the action of child sacrifice, but that God praises blind obedience, that forgets what it is to be in relationship with God and just slavishly obeys words, even when they're evil. That's what I can't settle with in this text, is that God would ask us, would create us to be so unthinking. The God who tells us that we are to love and to serve with all of our hearts and souls and minds and spirits would ask us to shut part of that off and commit violence against somebody else. The text says that this was good. And so here is my, I am certain, completely heretical statement. The text is wrong. The text, in its statement that we are to do something like that, the text is wrong. There is nothing, I'll get to you, George, there is nothing that can tell us that we can or should inflict violence on other people. Physical violence or emotion. I mean, imagine, he didn't kill his son, but he inflicted violence upon his son. And there is nothing that tells us we can do violence to others and then get out of it by saying, well, God asked me to do it. There is nothing that says that we can or should harm, maim, kill innocent children in the name of the God of love and of life. This story is telling us something else. This story is pointing us to something else. It's teaching us something else, because it cannot be telling us that this is okay. If the text is telling us that the blind adherence, that forgetting that we are to talk with God about this stuff, dialogue with God about this stuff, pray to God about this stuff. If the text is telling us that that goes out the window, if the text is telling us that we are mindless, then the text is also telling us to challenge, to question, that we need to still be in a relationship, in a dialogue with God, that we can't ever let that go. And in that, the text provides its own lesson. This story is giving us its own lesson. Because you see, if I was the God of the universe, and I wanted to somehow communicate to people throughout space and time that they should never, ever let go of their relationship with me, that they should never, ever let go of that ability to talk with me, to dialogue with me, that they should never accept that I, the God of the universe, the God of love and of life, would tell them to harm others. And this is not the only place in the Bible where God's words are words of harm, of violence, of murder. If I wanted to tell people that they should question that they should look at the text and look at what people say. I told you, you don't have to listen to everything I say. You've got to question it. If I wanted to teach people that they had to question even words that are spoken with authority, written with authority, even words that they think come from me, when those words tell them that God is bloodthirsty and brutal and wants the death of children. If I wanted to somehow communicate that to people, I'd tell them a story. I would tell them a story about a man who was respected and loved. I would tell them a story about a man whose faith was admirable, but whose relationships were questionable. I would tell them a story about a man whose love for his son transcended all else except his love for God. And I would tell them a story of how that caused pain. I would tell them a story that would cause in them such a struggle, such a reaction that they couldn't help but say, God, I got to pray to you about this. I got to talk to you about this. I don't understand this. I got to work with you on this. I would tell them a story that would teach them that I am a God who wants them to talk to me, wants them to pray to me, wants them to ask me, what in the world is going on? And if I were the God of the universe, I'd tell them a story like that. I'd give them a story that taught them to never stop talking to me, never stop praying to me, never stop trusting in me, never stop asking the difficult questions. And that, I believe, is one of the things that God did.